What are you emotionally excited about in the upcoming year?
I truly feel, Nishant, the situation we are in as the whole planet, with coronavirus particularly, I think as challenging as it is a great reminder that we all need to reform and reinvent our ways of being and our ways of living. What is exciting for me is that I hope people see that light. They see that optimistic side of things. And I know it's not easy for everyone because people are suffering from it, directly or indirectly. But, you know, for many of us, we can start thinking differently on why are we here on this planet? And every act we do, it matters. How we throw our trash and what we recycle, what we compost, all the way to using our words wisely, to caring and nurturing and supporting nonprofits and social ventures to really take roots and start thinking about this, operating this world in a very different way. I'm seeing some signs and I hope they just keep getting stronger. So that's what I'm excited about. Personally, I will stay on this path and continue contributing and multifolding my way of being. That's a promise I'm making to myself. But I hope that happens for many, many, many of us on this planet.
You may control people physically by force, but you won't change their hearts and minds. That requires trust and friendship. Dalai Lama. Hey, my friends, this is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. This is a podcast about helping you live a fulfilled life, and my job on this show is to invite the world-class experts to extract the practices, routines, and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. Lately, I have been asked many times how to start a podcast and understand the basic philosophy and fundamentals of starting a podcast. If you would love to talk to me, I'm happy to help you. Just go to my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me, and send me an email. Today's guest is Ruchika Sikri. Ruchika is the head of well-being, learning programs and strategy at Google. For over 20 years, her daily meditation and yoga practice is grounded in increasing clarity in mind, purity in heart, and sincerity in action. She believes these skills are increasingly needed to uplift humanity, build genuine connections, and increase respect for our planet. Her goal is to bring secular and science-based mindfulness and compassion learning to organizations and communities globally. She has successfully architected several well-being and mindfulness programs for over 120,000 employees at Google. Outside of Google, she is a board member and advisor to several nonprofits that are involved in empowering women in shelters. She is a mother of two loving kids and lives with her wonderful husband in Bay Area, California. Without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Ruchika. Ruchika, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nishant. Glad to be here.
Finally, we are able to do this recording third time after so many technical glitches. I'm glad that we are having this conversation finally. So I thought if we could start with something funny. If you're in a social gathering, Ruchika, and somebody asks you, what do you do for work? Then how would you respond?
Well, I just say I help people reflect who they really are and find themselves and live a life full of meaning and purpose.
That is a strong promise, living a life of a strong meaning and purpose. So how do you do that?
You know, I think we already are born to live a life of meaning and purpose. And sometimes we lose it, you know, along the way because of a lot of noise that gets created as we grow up, unintentionally mostly, Nishant, you know, through our school system, our society, through our family systems, we just get fed to do certain things in life which we may not be born to do. So, you know, I have found it to be true for myself where, you know, we just sit and reflect why we are here. For me, it was like be of service to others. And it was as simple as that. And the paths open up. And one of the paths for me has been the mindfulness practice, learning that myself, practicing it myself, and helping others learn and practice as well. And I found that, you know, people who have done this or adopted this in their life have found a more meaningful way to live and have found more purpose in their life. So it's as simple as that, and it's also complex, you know, if you go deeper into it.
It can be complex, certainly, and I would love to go into the weeds in a while, into mindfulness and meaning and purpose. So before that, I want to ask you, Ruchika, where did you grow up and how was your childhood like?
I grew up in India. I grew up in a small town near New Delhi. And it was a very small place at that time. Now it's very connected to the capital. But I kind of lived my life in a cocoon, Nishant, and I didn't even know that I was in a cocoon. I was happy. I was satisfied. I had a good family, mom, dad, younger brother, and a lot of family members around me. And I felt that was my world. And yeah, so no, you know, it was, of course, you know, just like having the typical challenges that everyone has in their lives about learning and growing and financial difficulties and identity of a woman growing up in India. All of that, you know, did show up all through my life. But if I look back at it, I think they were all like great learning and lessons, which has just made me who I am today. And all of the learnings I'm having today is going to make me what I am in the future. So I lived with my mom and dad, and my grandma used to live with us. And that was highly influential on my upbringing. She was a pot full of love and care and nurturing. And I feel very grateful that I had a grandparent living with me as I grew up. She inculcated a lot of good values and made me feel safe, you know, and protected and loved, I think, as every child deserves.
Could you share some of the lessons that you learned from your grandmother along with those values and love?
Yeah, you know, caring for others selflessly. Honestly, that would be one lesson I live by every day. She had five daughters and one son, and she worked very hard all her life to bring up the kids. And it's not unusual for people in that day and age to have that many children. But I saw her work very hard. Like, she would wake up 5 a.m. in the morning. She was an Arya Samaji, which a lot of Indians, if they hear this word, they will relate to it. But, you know, she would do her havan, which is basically offering to the god of fire every morning. And then she would just get to work. We had buffaloes in the house, so she would like get, you know, fresh milk out and make fresh butter for us and make fresh food for us and just work tirelessly all day, like, you know, starting from 5 a.m. till 10 p.m. And I really learned that by watching her more than, you know, the words she would use to give that value to me. And I truly believe, Nishant, like, you know, when we are children, and even now I would imagine, we learn more from watching others than listening to others, you know? So something taps into us. So I would say, yeah, working selflessly, giving selflessly, and loving with abundance are some of the values that I took from her.
In the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned about mindfulness. Did you grow up in a family where people practice mindfulness or any meditation?
No, not at all. We had a lot of ritualistic aspects of our culture incorporated in my family life, but we didn't have yoga, meditation, mindfulness, even though all of this was present all around us. In India, we didn't formally practice anything. My interest in mindfulness actually started about 14, 15 years ago when I joined Google. So, you know, I found a group of people who would sit together and meditate. And that's when my journey started. Before that, for 20 years, I've been practicing yoga, you know, going to local studios, practicing in groups. But no, not in India.
So as we are talking about your family and childhood days, I'm having this question right now in my mind. If you could talk to us, any challenge, any memorable challenges or any instances from your childhood that really made something out of you?
Yeah. You know, it was a challenge, and now I look at it as an opportunity, really. You know, my dad is an amazing human being. You know, he tried a lot of different ways to keep his family endowed with all the financial benefits that we needed. And, you know, he was a businessman. He had, you know, ups and downs in his life. And, you know, there were some downturns that we faced from financial perspective that was quite challenging, I remember. So, you know, to a degree where we were really constricted on things we could do and, like, you know, limited lifestyle that we could live. For example, like, I didn't have television in my home until I was 10 years old. We didn't have a car until, like, I was 16, 17 years old. And that was not a void for me, to be honest. It felt like, oh, it's normal, you know, and people around me were like me as well. So it didn't feel like I am deprived of something. But, you know, as I kind of started growing up and learning at school and, you know, watching other people, there's some instinct that comes up. You're like, wow, we could do better financially. And that became quite an intense motivation for me at that time. In India, you know, my generation of women didn't quite have, not all of them, I'm not generalizing, but in my close family, we didn't have a lot of impetus to, like, oh yeah, women needs to go and, you know, make money or be in business or work at some place. We were kind of stereotyped to be like, okay, well, yeah, you are a woman and you will get married to a husband who will take care of you all your life. And that would actually really, you know, annoy me. And I'm like, why is it like that? And especially when I saw my family in financial need, and especially when I was, like, getting close to high school and college time, I realized that I can also make contributions and help out. So that really spiraled me to take my education very seriously and also start thinking on the side on how I can provide, you know, financial help to my family as well. So I would say, yeah, that was quite a challenge. And, you know, in the hindsight, I look at it, it was such an opportunity for me to tap into all of the potential I had inside me. If that challenge wouldn't have been there, I probably wouldn't have worked so hard or strived so much to get to, you know, like, where I am, whatever that means today, but feeling very safe financially and, you know, all of the good stuff that comes along with that.
I would love to ask you a follow-up question on this.
Yeah.
How did you contribute financially to your family at that point?
How did I contribute? So when I started my college, which was a big move for my family, you know, even going from my small town to New Delhi to study was a big leap of, you know, trust that my dad particularly had to make. Like, how can this girl be on her own, you know, all day going to college? He's like, just go to a local college. And I'm like, no, I want to go to this particular college in Delhi. And then I started the college, and then I got motivated to get my software programming certificate as well. So I joined another institute, like, just maybe 6 months into college. So that was my second certificate degree program that I was pursuing. And then, you know, a year and a half into it, I also found an internship while I was working, while I was studying at college and getting my software engineering diploma. So my day, Nishant, would start at like 6:30 a.m. when I would get on a bus. And I would just go to college, attend college till 2, go to my software engineering institute, get there by 3, get my, you know, education there till 6 p.m. And then, you know, at 6:30 p.m., I would go and work for a couple of hours. And then I will take a bus back and I'll get home by, you know, 10:30. So which, you know, it was interesting, like how everything just came to support me wonderfully around that. And of course, it was so much hard work. And I didn't mind that at all. I was like really on a high of like owning my life and working independently to craft a life that I would like to live. So, you know, as a result of like working, I could also support myself and my family financially as well.
Your story actually reminds me of some of my old days back in Delhi when I was working. I was working for a company in Delhi for 4 or 5 months, and it used to take 2 to 3 hours to get to the office. Mm-hmm. And then 2 to 3 hours in the evening time. So there was a long travel time and in that scorching heat and in that cold time. So I can imagine those tough times that you are talking about. So Ruchika, we all have struggles, challenges, tough times. Everybody goes through that. So what advice or any recommendation would you give to somebody who is struggling right now or who may not know what is going to happen next?
You know, it's very hard to see the light when you are in so much darkness.
It is.
You know, so I want to keep it real for whoever is listening to this and are finding themselves in that dark spot. And as you said, you know, no one is alone experiencing that dark time in their life. There are a couple of things, you know, which if helpful, you can remember. One is that life is constantly changing. There are good times and then there are dark times in life. So know that this is temporary and you will get through it. Okay. And second, I would say is like, believe in yourself. Believe in something that may be higher than you. But believing in yourself matters, and it can become difficult. So I am sharing that as well. And if it is that situation that it's like really becoming hard to even believe in yourself, you know, really reach out and lean on others, someone who can support you, someone who can understand you, someone who does not need to give you advice, but they can just listen to you and validate that, you know, the pain and suffering you're feeling is there. And, you know, remind you that this may be temporary and that they are there for you, you know, to get through this stage of life. So, and you will get through this life, you know, we've all been there and, you know, we will also see more of those ebbs and flows in life. One time I read this quote that something that doesn't kill you make you stronger, right? So mm-hmm. Stay alive, stay strong and see what this phase of life has come to teach you. I think there are so many great big lessons hiding in the sufferings of life.
Could you tell us about that quote, if you remember?
Yeah, the quote is, something that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I don't know who said it, but I saw it probably on Instagram or Facebook somewhere.
As we are talking about quote, I would like to state one quote that I copied from your Twitter profile. You may control people physically by force, but you won't change their hearts and minds. That requires trust and friendship. It is from Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. Is there any other quote that inspires you or any life philosophy that you live your life by, Ruchika?
You know, there are so many, Nishant. I can think about it for a few minutes. The philosophy that really drives me these days, however, is, you know, this relationship with constant change in our lives, you know, especially in these times when there's so much complexity around us with coronavirus, with politics, with countries fighting with each other, people losing their jobs, people losing their loved ones. There is just a lot of complexity around us and a lot of change around us. You know, the analogy that I use in one of the programs that we teach is is to stay mindful, like a flagpole. You know, if you see a flagpole that is always steady in the ground, right? But what do you see with the flag? It's fluttering. If the winds get stronger, the flag is going to flutter even more, right? However, you know, being that pole, that flagpole is the practice. Sometimes we can do it in a formal way by sitting down and meditating and seeing and watching all the emotions, the feelings, the thoughts, the anticipations, the ruminations come up. And sometimes we are faced with that in real life, you know, getting sick, losing a job, you know, being away from family, being bothered by political state of a country, or you know, any other complexity that could be coming up. So I say, like, you know, practicing formally with any type of inner reflection practice. So you are connected with yourself, you know what your strengths are, and then applying that in real life when life asks for it. There's a beautiful story, like I can tell.
Please.
Yeah. So one time a sage said to a new meditator that, look, the easy retreat is in the jungle. When there is no one there, you go and sit under a tree and you are doing a retreat, right? You're meditating. The medium retreat is in the city. So when you are living in a real life and you're trying to stay centered when there's just so much noise around you, not just audio sound, the visual, the sensory, everything. And then the hardest retreat is in the emperor's court. And what that means is that, you know, when life asks you or gives you or sends you to a dark spot, how do you show up? Where is your flagpole at that time? How strongly is it placed in the ground matters. So, you know, do the retreat in the jungle, do the retreat in the city so that you could show up in the emperor's court when life asks you to give. And that's the philosophy, one of the philosophies like I live by. And it keeps me steadfast into my daily practice of yoga and meditation. And also, you know, the practice in the moment of being kind, being forgiving, being compassionate, prioritizing love over everything else and connection over everything else. So I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. Yeah. In a very, very nice way. So thank you, Ruchika, for answering in a great detail. I want to ask you about your meditation practice. And you started meditation, you can correct me if I'm wrong, about 15, 16 years ago. What challenges did you face when you were starting meditation?
Yeah, I hated it, Nishant. It's not easy, you know. We are so used to numbing ourselves from everything else happening around us, the stimulation, you know, the hard feelings that we have, the gripes we hold in our heart, the anger in our brain everywhere. You know, we just numb ourselves all our life, you know. Okay, well, let's go shopping, let's watch a TV show, let's go for a movie. There's nothing wrong with
it. Escape.
Yeah. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I still enjoy all of that. I love going shopping with my daughter. You know, that's one of my things to do with her. And, you know, and at the same time, like when you start meditating, what happens is you're just sitting with all of those thoughts, all of those emotions, all of the pains and sensations in your body that you were not even aware of. And this, I remember very clearly when I sat down in a group meditation for the first time, all of that came up. And I was like, those 20 minutes felt like 20 years to me. And I got out of there with experiencing a little bit more calmness towards the end. And I'm like, what happened here? And I reflected on that a lot. I didn't go back for a couple of weeks. I had a good mentor and a friend, and we talked about this. And, you know, they held my hand to really, you know, just stay with it if I can and keep trying it. So slowly and slowly, you know, it did start making a big difference. And I started feeling a big change and a shift in the way I treat myself you know, my inner critic got quieter. I was more kinder to myself. I was more kinder to people around me. I was a little bit more relaxed about even the deadlines, you know, which we make ourselves, and then we just run around them like dogs chasing their own tail, you know? So yeah, I think my experience initially was hard, but now I look forward to it. You know, it's like the nectar I have to drink every day in order to really stay present with whatever may come and show up that day.
Do you still talk to your same mentor?
You know, I've been really privileged to have many mentors in my life now, Nishant. And that's the beauty of it. You know, when you open up to a path, the path opens up to you. So I do stay in touch with my original mentor and teacher. And I have so many more that have come along, and I've had the opportunity to mentor many on the path as well. And, you know, we put a label on it, like mentor or a teacher. You know, I really feel we're all each other's teachers in this lifetime, and we're all students of each other. Now, I'm learning so much from you about you. You're probably learning a lot about me. And
for sure.
Now. So just keeping that lightheartedness on this learning journey, in this practice journey, is super helpful also.
And I would like to say that, and this conversation is very natural, free flow. You know, there is no effort. I love what we are discussing right now, Ruchika. And this is all coming from your open-heartedness, where we can share kindness and love.
Yeah, I feel so too, Nishan. So thank you for being a good host. And
we are not done yet.
I know. I'm giving you a compliment midway.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. So what time of the day do you meditate?
I meditate in the morning now, but because I'm at home and I'm able to do it. But, you know, if there is a situation when I have to commute to work or I have to travel for work, I meditate when I can and when I feel I need it. In fact, I was leading a group meditation today, and someone joined the meeting and they said, well, they were just closing a multi-million-dollar sales deal. And they stopped everyone in that meeting and said, well, this is not as important. I need to go meditate. And if you want to join me, come join me. And they brought two other people with them in the group meditation. So so what I'm trying to say is, like, don't get shackled into like, oh, morning is the best time, especially if you're starting off. You could meditate, like, you know, I sometimes meditate for 5 minutes before I go to bed. It helps me have a better night's sleep. I meditate for 10 minutes if I have a big presentation to make to a large group. But my deep practice, which I've established, mind you, after 15 years of staying at it, failing multiple times, getting back on my cushion and doing it again, I try to do it every morning for 15, 20 minutes along with my yoga.
And this is like a muscle. It grows and grows over a period of time. It's not going to work in a first shot. It's going to take time, weeks, months, and years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you wake up in the morning, what do you do in the first 60 to 90 minutes?
These days?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I have a big glass of water after I wake up, you know, because that just really helps me, you know, feel the energy and cleanse my system. So, and then I get on my yoga mat. As I mentioned to you earlier, I'm doing my yoga teacher training these days. So I have an hour and a half of yoga, intense yoga, and another 30 minutes of meditation. So that's my 2 hours, which is more than 90 minutes these days. And I love it. You know, I go to bed very early in the night because I have to wake up so early, but you know, it's...
What time do you go to bed?
I go to bed by 9:30 or 10 some days. 10:30. Otherwise, my kids now probably know that I'm a very cranky mother. If I have to stay up after 9:30 or 10 o'clock, I feel like I'm a baby now.
Have you discussed or taught meditation or other mindfulness practices to your children?
Oh, yeah, I have, in subtle ways. You know, I'm not like, okay, here is a stick in my hand and everybody get on the yoga mat and we're going to do yoga. I'm saying it because there are a lot of parents, especially in India, who believed in the science and the practice of yoga, did pass this amazing knowledge and tradition to their children in a very, very strict way. The way I do it is, you know, do a lot of mindful listening and talking with my 16-year-old teenager and doing a lot of connection time, bedtime routine with my almost six-year-old son. And so, you know, I cater to the need that they have. And I also subscribed, at least my daughter, who is now 16, that she's taken meditation programs outside. Sometimes the kids don't learn the best from their parents, but they're better off when they're with their peer group and they're learning from a teacher who's trained to teach a particular age group of students. So she's taken multiple meditation programs externally. So I know that the seeds have been planted and I hope they will stay nourished all her life so she can continue, you know, coming back to her inner self when the world around us gets complex, which
About a few months ago, I was recording with Elisha Goldstein. He's got a big name in the mindfulness space. And he was discussing a story about somewhere around 1:30 a.m., his son was not able to sleep well. And then his son called him and Elisha started to, you know, offer guided meditation to his son and they were having some conversation. So I asked him, I remember that question, hey, Elisha, I would love to know if you could share that conversation between you and your son, if you remember. He shared that. So Ruchika, I'm curious to ask you if any conversation between you and your daughter that you remember that has made tremendous amount of impact on you positive.
On me or on her or both of us?
Both of us.
Both of us. Okay. You know, there has been so many, Nishant. I'm trying to jog my memory to remember one. You know, life gets quite interesting when we step into teenage phase of our life. You know, there is this sudden shift of like, you know, you are now stepping into an individual human being personality from being a child who has been nurtured and taken good care, you know, if the circumstances allowed that. And so, you know, there were many situations where, as Dan Siegel, our friend in this space, you know, works so much with teenagers and also parents to help us understand like how their nervous system is working and how their emotions are really riling up and what roles can parents play to not solve for everything, but for being there for them when there is a difficult situation coming up. And there are so many instances when things happen at school, you know, just really taking the time to listen and not start solving or telling them that they could have done better, she could have done better, you know, has helped us build a lot of trust and safety. And sometimes there are problems with the amount of work you get at school and you're not able to keep up with it. Having conversations with her around that and helping her solve for those challenges herself rather than me giving her a prescription on like, okay, get the math work done first and here's how you should do it. Really, like, you know, helping her learn how to navigate these paths so that then she can apply these examples in her real life when she is independently functioning in the world have been really instrumental in building a very, you know, trusting relationship with her. And also, I would say dropping, you know, this real intense desire to judge. We all have it. And sometimes we bring it to our parenting as well. You know, the only reason most parents do it is to protect their children. But they end up harming. We end up harming our children when we say like, you should have done it this way rather than that way. And you better do it this way next time. You know, that's what my Dalai Lama's quote, I go back to that and say, you know, you cannot change hearts by saying and telling things to them, but allowing for the space for that learning to come up on its own can make that major shift happen and that impression land in their own psyche that can like help them, you know, bring that back up when they need it in their real life. So yeah, there's been just so many instances about friendships or school or work, even like with my little one, 5 years, I know you didn't ask for it, but
please tell me.
There is like a lot of emotions that can come up. And, you know, he often now comes and tells me I'm feeling very angry. So I really get to like first, you know, acknowledge that like, yeah, you really are feeling angry. I can feel it, that you are really hurt. You're angry. You're sad. So just number one, validating that their emotions are real and not just kind of saying like, hey, get over it, you know?
Yeah, which is natural, common these days.
Yes. And then just sitting with them and like, you know, helping them realize like, where are they feeling the anger? As we know that we actually feel all of these emotions as physiological responses. And that's before our brain can actually interpret them, we often end up having a reaction like, throwing something down, stomping their foot, or, you know, doing something naughty where, you know, they will get more in trouble. So just really validating them and helping them understand that their feelings are really true and they are their present, and asking them like what would be helpful in the moment. And then sometimes he would just say, nothing, I just want to be angry right now. And I'm like, okay, honey, you be angry and I'll sit with you until your anger goes away. And we can let it sit until it sits with us. So those are the ways, like, you know, I try to inculcate these practices in their real lives. And I'm not perfect at it, Nishant. I'm not tooting my horn. Life is full for me. I'm a working mother, a homemaker. And, you know, I do these things like, you know, record for podcasts or speak at conferences. So my plate gets full quite quickly. And I have moments where I cannot manage my emotion. And if I snap at them for something, then, you know, I take responsibility to then go and explain myself to them that, look, this is how Mom's Day was going.
This is very beautiful, the way you are explaining that, validating others' emotions and just being there, listening and not trying to judge, not controlling. Wonderful. So how, as a listener to this podcast, I'm wondering that if I struggle with all these things or maybe one of few things, then how should I practice or what could be the resources or books that I can learn from and apply it in my life?
About how to navigate this for a child?
Yes. Or any navigating negative emotions. As a child or as an adult?
As an adult. You know, I've started calling negative emotions unpleasant emotions and positive emotions pleasant emotions, right? So this, you know, emotion is an emotion, Nishant, and we have completely diluted the power of an emotion. The emotion needs to be there. We just need to learn how to regulate it in order to make full use of it. You know, when people get angry about a cause and they show up as activists in that space, they make major changes happen, right? Like they make major reforms happen. And, you know, love has its own space, happiness has its own space, frustration has its own space. So to recommend the books, I'm actually just turning around really quick to see. I am a big fan of Sharon Salzberg's work. You know, she really makes it very simple. She's written many, many books around it. If you are trying to regulate your emotion with respect to the workplace, then read her book on Real Change in Workplace. I think it's what it's called.
I think it's a new book, right?
Real Change is the new book. But then she had another book, which I'm losing the title right now. It'll come to me. But it is about, like, you know, how do you practice this stuff in a workplace? Then Pema Chodron She's an amazing author as well, and a teacher who I revere a lot. And in my darkest moments of time, like, I pick up her book, which is all about when things fall apart.
Yeah. So many people on this podcast have recommended that book.
Yes.
And to my shame, I've not read it.
Yeah. You know, you have it by your side.
No.
Then you can read it. And another book I would recommend, you know, we need motivation to practice this work. And there is a book by Viktor Frankl. It's called The Man's Search for Meaning.
I keep this book in front of my workplace every single day.
Yeah, that is a very amazing, profound book that changed my life, you know, for sure.
What changes did you observe after reading that book?
You know, just the enormity of perseverance that a human being is born with, right? Like, it's just amazing to, like, visualize the pain, the suffering that he describes from the time of Holocaust, and how he experienced excruciatingly painful circumstances and survived through that. And, you know, I keep that perspective, Nishant, always alive in my mind, where when I get stressed out about a presentation I need to make or a project deadline I need to make, I'm like, wow, like, compare this suffering to that suffering. When, you know, a human being can actually suffer that much and they can survive and thrive through it and can just come out so beautifully to share that knowledge with the world, you know, what potential do I hold and what do I want to make of this small stress that's coming up for me right now? So, huge perspective shift, I would say, that I keep in mind and I also bring to my attention. I have several copies of it. There's one in my car, there's one in my bookshelf, there's one in my bedroom.
I actually read one specific chapter from this book, and the name is Tragic Optimism: How to Be Optimistic in Pain and Suffering. And I take it as a realignment to my meaning and purpose in life. There are times when self-doubt creeps in, when there is a time you just don't feel like to do the kind of work you're doing. And that's when I reread these chapters to realign myself on why I'm here, why I'm doing, to just sort of an alignment. If you keep driving the same car without maintenance, one day the car is gonna stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful too. Yeah. The optimism. Oh, absolutely. And the analogy you're using of, like, maintaining our car is right on the spot. You know, we need to take care of our body and our mind, maintain it, give it all the nurturing and care. And the way I kind of see it is as not as an unselfish act is, you know, it's a container that we have to keep filled in order to serve others from this container. Guess what? You cannot serve others from an empty container. So you have to take care of yourself. And that's what makes it more of a necessity than a luxury to sit and meditate or to go for a walk or to talk to a friend. Do all of those things.
Yes. And Ruchika, I would love to ask you about your mindfulness venture at Google. How do you bring mindfulness to a company like Google? You have had programs, learning programs to more than 120,000 Google employees globally, and you're bringing secular and science-based mindfulness and compassion programs. How do you teach mindfulness and compassion to those tech heads?
Just what you said, Nishant, in a very secular way and in a very scientific, evidence-based manner is how we teach them. In fact, they are the ones who started it, right? Like, you know, the group, the person who started meditation, mindfulness journey at Google is an engineer. He's not at Google anymore. He wrote the book Search Inside Yourself, Chade-Meng Tan. And that's when the journey started. And he was part of our group when I mentioned that I would go and sit in a conference room and meditate. So how do we do this at Google? So Google is an amazing place. I love it. And that's why I'm still there after 14 years. There is a lot of leverage for employees to do good work. Something that's helpful, something that's respectful, something that can make us all better. Better human beings, better colleagues, better contributors, more productive people, right? When we started, or when mindfulness work started at Google, it was a very grassroots effort. And what I mean by that is that there was no formal department encouraging, sourcing, and funding these programs initially. It was a bunch of us, and that crowd kept getting bigger and bigger over time, and you know, started having a global presence of very, you know, grounds up type of meditation community that started building. And then we soon realized that this is something that's very palatable to Googlers. I have been in people operations all throughout my career at Google. And I've done a lot of program design, development, management. People knew that I have a liking for meditation and yoga. It's funny, some of the people at Google would call me Lavender.
Lavender.
Because, you know, they felt that like I bring that calmness in the projects I kind of work with them. Like, I'll take that compliment, you know. We all need lavender in our life. If I can bring it to you, there you go. I'm here for you. So, and then, you know, I was like in the process of a role change, and I took a sabbatical for about a couple of months. And when I went back, you know, there was a lot of seriousness on making these programs more official, with headcounts and with resources and with funding and whatnot, because we were seeing a lot of demand for mindfulness learning going up. And Search Inside Yourself program particularly was quite seeked out at that time. So this was seven and a half years ago when I took on more of a strategy and operations and program management role in this space. And I honestly thought, Nishant, it's going to be like a 6-month project. I will establish this and I will, you know, move on to my next project. But gosh, it's been 7 years, you know, and so far I've still been doing it up until this week at the very least. And the way we bring it to Googlers is through Googlers. So, you know, what we realized is that we cannot have 100 teachers come from outside and help 120,000 Googlers learn about this content and then practice it. We needed to leverage and tap into the interest that was already present within the organization. So, you know, we created a community called GPause, which is Google Pauses, because we're running all the time. We got to pause to play better, is like what my tagline was for this project. And you know, now we have, you know, more than 350, almost about 400 volunteers around the world who teach these programs, Search Inside Yourself. We have a program called Fundamentals of Mindfulness. And then there are several other volunteers, part of this 400 volunteer community, that hold GPause meditation sessions in their local offices when the offices are open. Right now, they're doing it all online. And actually, that has just broken all the walls between the regions and the countries. And, you know, an Asia Pacific session may be joined by someone in the US because a 9 p.m. slot works out better for them to meditate. And so we really are scaling it in what we call it a G2G format, Googler to Googler format. And that's what makes it beautiful. It makes it worthwhile. It makes the motivation come up for employees from within, because they see that their peers have taken the program and they see how it has transformed them. And there are a lot of peers who are actually teaching and creating space for this to be learned by their other colleagues. So they find the validation in it. So basically my role was to create this ecosystem. It has been to create this ecosystem. And of course, I am one of the teachers and I'm one of the meditation leads of the 400 people we have. But I kind of sit in the central function that weaves the whole, you know, the whole piece of mindfulness into the fabric of Google's culture, essentially.
This is about bringing humanity. If we are teaching mindfulness and meditation at a workplace, then our relationship with our coworkers get much better. And when we go home, we can interact with our loved ones in a calm, relaxed way. Usually the myth is that when you go to work, you have to be a different person. No, we all are same when we go to work. We don't go with different mind or different body. It's all same. And if we are miserable in our personal life, that shows up at a workplace. So this is a great initiative to bring mindfulness at a workplace and how we can change or transform our personal life. So Ruchika, there would be many stories you get to hear from employees about their transformation. Do you recall any one story about their transformation?
Oh, there are several. You know, all of these volunteers who take time on top of their regular jobs are doing this work, Nishant, because they believe that this work, inner work, helped them and it transformed their lives. I cannot share their stories for maintaining confidentiality of it. But, you know, overall, anything from, you know, you'll be surprised. I often hear from recruiters, like sometimes people join Google over other companies because, you know, they get to learn that we have this whole body of mindfulness work at Google. And if they're passionate about it, that they can come and do this work at Google as well. Teach, learn, grow, develop, and co-create these programs as well. I mean, today, in fact, I was, you know, to point out a particular story, and you can go look on LinkedIn. I'm happy to share the link with you. We have two amazing volunteers, Adam Coelho and Nicholas Whitaker. A big shout out to them if they listen to this podcast, and to all the wonderful friends and volunteers who've really supported establishing these programs at Google. But Adam has been doing podcasts just like you with many people in this field. So he interviewed Nicholas. And you should go and listen to Nicholas's story directly about how, you know, these practices actually helped him tremendously with many facets of life.
Yes, so, I would appreciate if you could point us to the links later on.
Yes.
I will put it in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely.
Great, Ruchika. And I want to ask you something very funny.
Okay.
You don't have much social media presence. Why is that?
Because I'm heads down doing my work and I'm doing my best to be a good parent. You know, Nishant, that's a good point. It's very distracting for me. Even like one or few posts that I would make, you know, my mind just like keeps going out to check, like, oh, what are people reacting to? Because I'm so curious. I'm such, you know, one of the drivers for me, one of the strengths that I have is making connections and keeping connections and really paying attention to my connections. So when I make connections on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram, and I post something, I'm so curious to know how people are liking it or not liking it, or what are they saying about it. So it's too much of a distraction for me. And it's as simple as that, honestly. My social media consumption is low. And that's why you see my posting even much, much, much lower.
I was trying to dig down your Twitter account to find more information. And one post that I found long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, you had tweeted about, quote, just signed up on Twitter because Malini said so. Malini, I assume is your friend.
She's my friend, yes. Yeah, I didn't have any interest in like signing up for Twitter. You know, I'm happy with my WhatsApp, to be honest, because I have my closest family and friends groups in there. And we chatter, we post, we share all we want to. But, you know, my friends keep saying like, you should do Snapchat and this and that. And I'm like, oh my God. And like, there's a new app called Marco Polo, which I'm hearing great news about. But I just haven't, you know, had the intrinsic motivation to now go and sign up for it. But Molly is my friend, and you know, I really love her. And you know, she said like, yeah, let's sign up for Twitter. I'm like, okay, I'll go sign up for Twitter.
I can understand the distraction of social media. That's why I'm still using iPhone 5S. That doesn't allow me to, you know, install these apps because so small, like 8 GB memory, and I don't have any social media on my phone, only desktop based.
Yeah, that's wise. And I know that there is value in sharing and posting. And I say that because I am a benefactor of it. Like, so I subscribe to people who I get to learn a lot from, right? Like Jack Kornfield, Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, Sharon Salzberg, and Roshi Joan Halifax. So I'm on their networks and or I follow them. And there's just always beautiful learnings that show up either on Instagram as a quote or as a story someone shared. And it just like constantly deepens my trust and my faith and my conviction more so in staying on this path and continuing to give. And maybe at some point, Nishant, like as, you know, as life kind of takes me to newer spaces, you know, just to share some of the good things I've learned in my life to encourage people to follow their path as well. I may consider that. But right now, my hands and my plate, everything is so full that I can't afford that distraction.
Well, thank you so much for making time for this sure. in your plate. So Ruchika, I feel that this is the right place to wrap up our conversation, but I'm having another question for you. What are you emotionally excited about in the upcoming years?
What am I excited about? You know, I truly feel, Nishant, the situation we are in as the whole planet with coronavirus particularly, I think as challenging as it is a great reminder that we all need to reform and reinvent our ways of being and our ways of living. What is exciting for me is that I hope people see that light. They see that optimistic side of things. And I know it's not easy for everyone because people are suffering from it, directly or indirectly. But for many of us, we can start thinking differently on why are we here on this planet, and every act we do, it matters. How we throw our trash and what we recycle, what we compost, all the way to using our words wisely, to caring and nurturing and supporting nonprofits and social ventures to really take roots and start thinking about this, operating this world in a very different way. I'm seeing some signs and I hope they just keep getting stronger. So that's what I'm excited about. Personally, I will stay on this path and continue contributing and multifolding my way of being. That's a promise I'm making to myself. But I hope that happens for many, many, many of us on this planet.
Thank you so much, Ruchika. I really appreciate that. And last but not the least, where can our listeners learn about you, your work, or anything that you would like to share?
Yeah, I think LinkedIn is the best way to go. I don't have a website or anything right now, but my LinkedIn profile is most up to date and I welcome a lot of connections there. So if you are interested in this path, motivated about it, and want to stay on the path of learning and practice together, you can connect with me on LinkedIn.
I'm definitely motivated by you and inspired by you. So thank you so much, Ruchika. It was a heartfelt, mindful, loving conversation with you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Nishant.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. there is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You've got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.